This is Sarah Reith with Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. Today we'll hear from Jay Holden, a clinical psychologist and homesteader and the author of a poem some of our listeners might remember. I sat down with him at Grace Hudson Museum last summer.
I came here in 1970 to work at Mendocino State Hospital. Came here to do my psychology internship. I came from Ohio. That was the last year the state hospital was open. It closed right after that, and we had to make a decision. Do we want to go back to an urban lifestyle where I could find work? But suddenly, the state hospital was the largest employer here in the county, and suddenly there were a whole lot of unemployed mental health professionals on the streets around here. And the promise had been, this was during the Reagan years, this was called the deinstitutionalization movement. The idea being people are, rather than warehoused in state institutions, they're better treated in their local communities on more of an outpatient basis. And it was a great idea. However, a lot of money got lost in the translation, and the local mental health departments were not supported to the extent that the state hospitals had been. And a lot of people, this is when homeless people started showing up in the doorways of Market Street in San Francisco, homeless, mentally ill. And a lot of people in my position in the mental health field left the county to find work in urban areas, but we loved it so much here we decided to stay. And we did whatever it took to stay. We delivered phone books, picked grapes, cleaned motel rooms, did yard work. Until we could find employment, that was a difficulty here. There were not a lot of jobs here, especially after the hospital closed. There were rumors at the time from the old guard here that the closing of the hospital would turn Ukiah into a ghost town. What they didn't count on was people like me and a lot of people of our counterculture, we were called in that day, and the baby boomers and all that, who wanted the rural lifestyle. And found it up here, and decided to make their way one way or another to try to be able to stay up here. And that's what we did. Then a regular job opened up at North Coast Opportunities for me, and I moved forward to do that. And then I ultimately completed my psychologist license, and I work locally as a psychologist now.
And you mentioned earlier that you also worked for a newspaper. Can you talk about your involvement with the Mendocino Grapevine?
That was started by Stu Chapman, a guy from Willits, who just decided we needed something other than the Ukiah Daily Journal around here. He was one of us counterculture back to the land people, so he saw that movement happening and he created a voice for it. They got R. Crumb to do the masthead for it, classic. And some of the original cover art was his also. He lived in Powder Valley at the time with his wife, Dana Crumb. And I have always liked writing, so I submitted a poem to the paper in the early days called The Mendocino County Blues. There were a couple local musicians. Anybody who was around in those days, or for many years after that, know these people, Hanson and Raitt, Mark Hanson and David Raitt. They were the local troubadours singing to our generation, and we'd go to wherever they played to dance and so forth. And I submitted a poem, the Mendocino County Blues, and Mark Hanson called me up and he said, do you mind if I put music to that? And he did, and about the same time, there was a lot of opposition to this Back to the Land movement coming from some of the old guard here. We were not getting permits for the things we were building. We were into cutting corners and keeping things simple. We would buy properties that it amazed the real estate people that there was anybody interested in these properties because they were quite rural, undeveloped. But an opposition came up, and there was an effort to go out and red tag, as we used to call it in those days, all these structures, illegal dwellings, to try to discourage us, but didn't do a lot of good. We formed our own counter movement to that called United Stand. Anon Forrest was one of the leading forces in that. She was from Round Mountain Ranch, which was another area ranch that broke up into pieces because raising sheep, which a lot of the ranchers did here, was not really economically feasible anymore. And so the ranches broke up, and a lot of us Back to the Landers swooped it up. Greenfield Ranch broke up about that time, and it was selling at $150 an acre. We bought property across the street from that on Running Springs Ranch, which was more expensive. It was $300 an acre. But you could have, you could hold an individual title in smaller parcels. And Greenfield was a little more communal. There would be shared road expenses. The old ranch house was going to be communal. And I think they had 160-acre minimums over there. So there were a lot of people that threw into like partnerships, friendships, come on, let's make this work together out there. But that's how we got back to the land. You had mentioned earlier about midwifing and alternative birthing. You know, we really wanted a whole new vision of living in America that included going back to simpler rural values and practices, but we also wanted to reinvent a lot of things. We kind of reinvented birth and marriage and death, all three of them. Those were all in the hands of the church, by and large, back in the day. And we started having weddings outdoors, home births, and not using mortuaries for funerals. So we had a new vision. It was generally called Simple Living. We used to have Simple Living workshops at the Boonville Fairgrounds every year. And we followed, our Bible was a Whole Earth Catalog, which offered everything, the books on how to make shake shingles, how to can your own goods, how to live simply and back on the land, sort of in the old style. Patterned after the L.L. Bean catalog, actually, with photos and little stories and so forth. And that was our Bible, and we got our resources from that and just sort of communal get-togethers and sharing our experiences. It's amazing we were able to do all we did without cell phones. I just look back on how did people meet? I mean, we lived out in rural areas. It might take an hour to go see a friend, you know, but we did it. And we enjoyed the simple lifestyle. Ultimately, David Reid wrote an article said there is no such thing as simple living. We found out the hard way that things were not as simple as we had envisioned them. We did ultimately have to come up with some solution to the housing thing, for instance, and a non-forest came up with the idea of Class K housing that would allow structures to stand if we would allow building inspectors to come in and look at them and offer sort of deals, you know. Well, if you'll put a little more plumbing over here and there, we won't hold you to certain other standards since it's already built and so forth. So they came up with the ideas of detached bedrooms and Class K housing that allowed for some peaceful resolution of this conflict that was going on.
I want to go back a little bit. You said that you kind of reinvented birth and marriage and death. Can you remember any specific instances of those experiences that were done in a way that they hadn't been done before?
Well, on a personal level, I was approached by Dan Hamburg, known as Buzz Hamburg back in the day, and his wife, Carrie, wonderful, unbelievable human being. They came over to my house one day and asked me to marry them. Well, this was a whole new concept of getting married outside the church. And I asked them, I said, why me? Why would you ask me to do something like this? And I'll never forget, Carrie said, you're the only person we know that can talk about God without offending anybody. And I really took that as a great compliment. I wasn't exactly sure what it meant because we didn't use that word in the service at all. was not in any fashion a religious service, but we did understand the value of spirituality, and that we were disillusioned with the church and the way that they managed the issue, I might say, of spirituality, or corrupted it even, if I can go that far. And we were not pleased with it. People were flocking from the churches. A cover of Time magazine said, "God is dead." So it was very revolutionary, what we were trying to do here. And we had a revolution in consciousness, too. We were smoking pot, taking LSD, experimenting with alternative visions of the world and ways to experience and live in it. They had profound effects. One of the reasons I ended up at Mendocino State Hospital is they had a very active LSD research program out there. I got there within a year of when they made it illegal. But they were having profound results in their research with this, and they're starting to allow that research again today, and again are finding profound results with it. So we were messing with the entire paradigm, from our minds to the way, where we lived, how we lived, the essential milestones of life, birth, marriage, death. We wanted a new way to do that, and we sort of invented it ourselves. So I sat down and tried to figure what is a marriage. So I started with that, and I researched where that word comes from. So I incorporated that into the ceremony and came to see that it's really something that goes on between two people, and that a wedding is really only the observance of a marriage. It doesn't make a marriage. You can't legislate a marriage. You can't officiate a marriage. You can officiate a wedding that observes, celebrates, and shares what has happened between the couple. So my ceremonies would tend to focus mostly on a little history of marriage, where the word comes from, the different forms it's taken over the centuries, and focus principally on the couple. How did they meet? When did they know this was special? What kind of challenges have they had? How did the proposal come about? How did they decide to have this wedding rather than just go to the courthouse and have a clerk do it or run off to Reno and do it? So, but I think I've probably done over 150 of those. I think only one did I ever use a text that's from a church, and that's because that's what the couple wanted. Even then, they didn't want to have it in a church. They wanted to have it at their home. So that was going on. Home birth was going on, as I mentioned. Midwife, Lynn Meadows, was one of the first in this county from Greenfield Ranch. She midwifed my second kid. The first kid we had back in Ohio, standard way, in the hospital. Guy goes in the waiting room with a handful of cigars and paces up and down and waits for the news from a nurse. They weren't even allowing you into the delivery room in those days. By the time we had our second child, we had him here, there was an alternative. There was, midwifery was on the rise, and people were saying, we don't have to do this the old way. So again, we kind of reinvented. And again, it's funny, because some of these reinventions are going back to the way they originally were to begin with. Most of the world today, it does not require a minister or a signed license or something for a couple to be married. It requires a witness and stating in front of a witness, this is what's happened in our relationship. So it is funny looking on it now that a lot of these things, and burying people, Carrie Hamburg got buried on her own property. There were legal issues around that, and that's more recent even. But that used to be the way it was, and we were doing marriage the way it was, and living on the land the way it was. We were really highly progressive and highly regressive at the same time. It's kind of funny how that worked out.
And you mentioned that there was LSD therapy at the state mental hospital. I'm wondering if there were any profound experiences with psychedelics or alternative spirituality that informed your experience.
Well, yeah, I had taken LSD in Ohio before I came out here. I had told them in my thin little resume of those days as a graduate student that I had worked with people having bad trips, bad experiences. They were really interested in that because it was happening a lot on college campuses. People were taking it with no grounding, no frame of reference, no support, and some of them getting panicked, basically. This experience was too frightening, it was too upsetting, too different, a lot of worries about, will I ever be back to normal again or whatever. So my university appreciated that I had something to contribute to their counseling center about that. However, when I told them that I had actually taken it, I almost got drummed out of graduate school for that statement. That was a very unpopular statement in a very conservative university that I was in at the time. So yeah, I had had that experience, and my experience had been out in nature, and I came to really love being out in nature, just by the fact of being there, and then enhanced by the psychedelic aspect of it. But yeah, the research at the hospital was fantastic. The head of the internship program there headed a journal called the Psychedelic Review, so he was publishing these researches. So I was really interested, because I thought there was a lot of potential here, just on the human experience level, but also on the therapeutic level. As a psychologist, I was interested in the therapeutic values of it too. So yeah, those experiences did inform my decision to come here and my decision to stay here.
So you said you came here within a year of LSD being outlawed. Do you mean that you came here a year before it was outlawed or a year after it was outlawed?
That was a year after. So I just missed the boat on that one. But I did get to talk. His name was Bob Mogar, the head of the intern program out there, and who published this journal. So I read all the journals he put out, and we had many long discussions. There were a number of us at the hospital who had tried it ourselves and liked getting together and sharing our experiences and, again, our personal experiences and also our thoughts about how this could be an incredible therapeutic tool. So that remained a very stimulating subject, but of course it had to go underground. They got the hospital here had Sandoz Pharmaceutical LSD, which was the world standard. As soon as they announced the closing of the research program, all of that seemed to disappear somehow. All the inventory sort of vanished. And yeah, those were very glorious days. We had people like Alan Watts, Timothy Leary, other people coming up from urban areas to see what we were doing up here. We were doing some very advanced programs out at the hospital. Not just the LSD research one, but we had four different alcoholism units with different therapeutic approaches to that. We had one of the very first substance abuse programs. It was called The Family out there at the hospital. That was sort of following there was an outfit called Synanon that did a lot of that work in the days, but they were rooted mostly in the city. But we were having some very fantastic results on all those fronts. Adolescent wards, we had a couple of those out there, troubled adolescents. We were bringing sort of our new vision and our new hope to what had been traditionally a very static, institutionalized viewpoint on how to deal with people's mental health problems.
How long did you work there?
Well, it closed a year after I got there. That had nothing to do with me. I've assured myself of that over the years. This was a political agenda. I worked there, and then I was able to stay on as a research assistant and helped publish a couple studies that were sort of in process at the time they closed the hospital. But they kept the research department open to complete the studies that they'd started and get those published. So I worked there another year when there were really no patients there or staff. There were just little enclaves like that that were kept open for various purposes. So I worked a total of 2 years there, but 1 year in earnest doing my internship.
What about homesteading skills? Were you involved in the Class K fight or building your own house?
Well, the Mendocino County Blues became the anthem of United Stand. So I would always go to all their events, and they would always give me a shout-out for writing the lyric and stuff. And so, yeah, I got involved. I went to meetings. I went to when they make presentation to the supervisors or want to turn out. Again, I don't know how word got out. And not only did we not have cell phones, we didn't have answering machines, forced telephones. So as some of the listeners may not be able to imagine, and you call somebody's house and they're not there. They're not there. You have to try later. And that's how we communicated. It could be a couple of days before you got a hold of somebody. But somehow, this culture or counterculture, word just spread. It was amazing. The affinity we had for each other and our common purpose, our quote, United Stand, U.S. So they adopted that song, and we would have meetings, strategy meetings. How are we going to deal with this? What new ideas do we have? That's how the class cake idea came up. That's how the resistance to this authoritarian, let's go out and just shut all these places down, put red tags on them, and fine people or send them to jail if they continue to live in places like that. So it was a long struggle. It went on intensely for at least 5 years before anything real productive came out of it. And most of us came, it's funny, because most of us came to get away from that kind of thing, get away from government, get away from politics, get away from organized this, that, or the other, and just leave me alone and let me live on my, out in the woods, in my humble little house like Thoreau, and just not hurt people and not be an imposition, just leave me alone and let me live my life. And yet we ended up being very communal about it. And there were communes around the county at that point, too. That was being experimented with. I personally didn't quite buy that level of community. I thought, this is going to be a lot of complications. I think I'll just have my own private property over here. But I was very supportive of the whole thing and would help any way I could.
So how did you figure out your homesteading skills? Did you have skills when you got here? Or did you just have to kind of wing it?
You know, when I got here, I didn't know water flowed downhill. It was a great revelation to discover gravity feed for water. Oh, my goodness. Wow. You know, and because we would have to, we'd get out there in the hills. Okay, here we are. You got any water? You got a glass of water? Oh, water. Oh, yeah, right. Water. What a concept. So we'd have to, I saw hand-dug wells 100 feet deep that didn't get a drop. I mean, it was tough trying to reinvent the wheel, basically, or the pump in this case, the water pump. So, I was very naive, but open and willing to learn and willing to be poor and struggle and find my way through it because it seems such a worthy thing to do. I got a lot of black thumbnails from pounding my first nails. There were issues around, can you use recycled materials in a house? That was a big struggle because the building codes are written by builders, you know. They want new plumbing, they want new materials, they want data. Oh, my goodness, they want roofs strong enough to hold 6 feet of snow on them. That's never going to happen here, but we had to contend with that and come up with alternatives.
Did you have any mentors, old-timers who'd been here and already knew how to do it?
You know, some of the old-timers got a kick out of us. Well, these kids are going to try this again. Okay. There was a guy named Shorty. He was a great guy. Right across from the Ukiah Movie Theater, where there's a bank now, there used to be a motor court there with these separate little units, and you'd park next to your unit and all this. Well, that was being demolished. So we came in. This was also the days before big lawsuits. And so we asked the bank who had bought the property, do you care if they're going to bulldoze the property and just put it in dump trucks and take it out to the dump? Do you mind if we get in there a few days before that and get some materials? We didn't even sign a waiver or release, nothing. They said, yeah, go ahead. So we had a great time. One guy stepped on a nail, unfortunately, but that healed up. But we got a whole bunch of materials out of those little cottages. And I built my first little place. It was a door from unit number 9. So I had that door, and I had 9 on it. And number 9 was a big deal in those days because the Beatles had a song out about number 9, the revolution. And I brought Shorty out to show it off to him, and he said, oh, boy. He said, you're going to have trouble when the rains come because I didn't build an overhang off the edge of the walls, you know, so it was going to run right down the walls or slide up under the walls. He said, you need to build an extension out. So he gave me a tip on something like that. And water witches, they were fun. They'd come out with a willow stick or a hanger, a regular clothes hanger, you know, that they had bent in a certain shape. And they'd walk around and they'd tell you where the water is and how deep it is and what the flow is. It was quite an art. I have to say, we got finagled a number of times. We drilled a lot of dry holes before we actually hit it, but often they would hit. They were the best. There was no other, how else are you going to find water that's underground but somebody who can sense it one way or another? Willow sticks is what they like to use. They like the willows because willows are very attracted to water. They thrive in water, so they have some natural affinity toward water. And these people could sense by moving their willow stick around as they walked around, they could sense when that stick was reacting. And then they'd find a spot, and then they'd move that stick up and down and around a little bit, and they'd count the seconds between the bounces in the stick and tell you how deep it was. It was quite amazing. It was great.
What about wild animals? Do you remember any experiences with wildlife?
Well, there was this rattlesnake. Once again, I'd never seen one of those before in my life. And that was probably the biggest hazard. There were also coyotes out there who liked going after the sheep, but they didn't show up around people much. An occasional mountain lion or something, but a lot of deer. And then, like I say, there was the rattlesnake. I mean, that's a whole story in itself, but I learned a lot from that rattlesnake. And it learned a lot from me, and we parted our ways peacefully and never saw each other again, but I learned what I needed to know about them. You don't want to step on them. You don't want to scare them. They don't chase you. They're not after you. If you cross paths with them, they're as embarrassed about it and uptight and as scared about it as you are. So the idea is to reduce the fear, not to go on the attack. Yeah, I learned some very good lessons about that, that the way to get bit in life is to scare somebody or hurt somebody. Don't step on them and don't frighten them, and they're probably not going to hurt you, whether it's people or rattlesnakes.
Well, is there anything that you want to add before we wrap up and get kicked out of the museum?
I will recite for you the Mendocino County Blues. United Stand put a different ending on it than I had, but I'll recite it to you the way that I wrote it. The house inspector told me got to tear my dwelling down. Employment service told me there ain't no jobs around. My school and all seems useless. Sometimes feel like a bum. Can't afford to drive my truck, and the Cadillac fans my thumb. But it's so beautiful here. I met the spirit in the hills. Trout are spawning in the streams by fields of daffodils. There was a time when I was young, I tried to beat the man. I did just what I wanted, yeah, and landed in the can. But I have seen the light now. Fighting days are far behind. Ain't looking for no trouble now. I just want some peace of mind. Yeah, it's so beautiful here. Spotted fawns upon the field. Redwoods growing out of stumps. Mother Nature's plan revealed. Now I know how to make things grow, and I know how to share. I know how not to poison the water and the air. My brothers and my sisters, they lend a helping hand. But in Mendocino County, seems the man don't know the plan. Yeah, it's so beautiful here, valley fog and mountain views. Just wish there was a cure for these Mendocino County blues.
You've been listening to Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. We just heard a few highlights from a conversation with Jay Holden. You can listen again or tune in to a longer version on our webpage at kzyx.org. Promise of Paradise is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, California Humanities, the Arts Council of Mendocino County, the Judy Pruden Historical Preservation Fund of the Community Foundation of Mendocino County, the Mendocino Institute, and Grace Hudson Museum.
There's something happening here. I what it is ain't exactly clear.